public hearing on Senate Bill 258A and call David Bailey from PERS. Come on up. Are you going to talk to us about this bill?
How it works?
Mr. Chair, David Bailey. I'm Deputy Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. Recently got reading glasses. Senate Bill 258 was drafted as a result of working with Senator Farioli. And it's essentially an effort to provide an incentive to what we call inactive members of the system. They're people who are no longer working in a paid public position. They're also vested to be eligible for this bill, and it provides them an incentive to take their member account out, and after that they no longer have any right to a retirement benefit. The incentive is to provide them an additional 50% of the value of their account balance, so they receive their account balance plus 50%. And the savings come because of retirement. As you know, most of these folks will be eligible for a money match benefit where they get at least a match of their account balance. So there's some savings associated with this bill. Some of the wording of the bill and the timing of it, where a person has to be an inactive member as of January 1, 2000, was placed in there so that members who would normally take a 100% refund of their account balance would not be eligible for this bill. Kind of like if a retailer has a sale and they sell the same number of shirts during the sale as they normally would, then they're losing money. So to the extent that members would normally take a 100% refund, Senator Farioli wanted to eliminate their eligibility for this incentive. So that's why a member had to be eligible as of January 1, 2000. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Would you like me to go into the estimated savings?
Yeah, would you?
The actuary estimated the savings in a range of possibilities, and based on some assumptions, of course. One of the assumptions was that no one under the age of 45 would take advantage of this incentive. And the reason is that the closer you get to retirement, the less likely you would be willing to take advantage of this incentive. You'd probably be more likely to wait until age 55 when you're eligible for the money match.
You think this would apply to people mainly under 45?
Yeah, it would apply to any age, but our assumption was that a person under 45 is probably very unlikely to take this. I'm sure some people over 45 will take it, but probably a smaller amount. On the other hand, when we did these estimates, we weren't considering House Bill 2003, and if House Bill 2003 passes, it probably removes one of the incentives for people to leave their money in their account and apply for a retirement benefit someday. Because I think there's two incentives not to take this incentive. Put it that way. One is that you would earn 8%, so you'd see your account grow on a guaranteed rate. And the other is that you'd receive the match. House Bill 2003 would potentially remove the potential for your account to grow. So one of the reasons not to take this incentive would be removed by House Bill 2003. It's difficult to predict for us to predict how many people are going to take advantage of this. For most of the bills that we do assumptions on, we have some past experience, but this one we really don't. There's really nothing for us to go on.
how would the mechanics of it work then if an employee comes forward and wants to get theirs, get the match essentially, or they can take 150% of their account if it's, if the money obviously isn't there for the, for that, you know, they have 100% of their account and we're giving them 50% more. What's the mechanics of where that money comes from? Is that the employer comes forward and then matches it at that time?
That's correct. At the time of the not at that time. Actually, there'd be a charge made to their account, which then at the time of an actuarial valuation would become part of the assets versus liabilities valuation. And so it would be reflected in their rate. But it would be reflected in a positive way because the rate is estimating the value of future benefits, and this would lower the value of future benefit estimates. And so to the extent that people take the incentive, there would be savings.
Senator Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. State Senator Ted Ferrioli. I'm here to support Senate Bill 258. Colleagues, I think you probably heard all the nuts and bolts about this thing. Just, I wish we could get a better fix on what the buyout will actually say. The testimony I've heard on the bill, and I think the testimony you've heard on the bill just moments ago, indicates that people past the age of 45 are less likely to buy out. And I think that could be true. Probable. Nevertheless, people in the in this economy have taken a beating in the stock market. Some have lost their jobs. Some have kids who need college educations, and others have potentials to just walk away from the system and roll the dollars over into an IRA or a similar plan. And so we can't know what the motivations of people are. What we know with certainty is if they stay in the system until they retire, we're going to have to deal with the accruals of the guarantee and possibly future cost of living increases, depending on what the courts say and what this legislature does. We may even find at the end of the day that we're obligated to do the money match, notwithstanding any course corrections we try to make in the management of this fund. What's certain is that if these folks accept the offer, and we're creating a finite window when they can do that, this will act as a stop loss for the state of Oregon, because we'll pay these folks out 150% of their contributions that leave the system. The instantaneous savings is the balance that's left in the obligation portion of the state agency. And we're estimating that that's probably 30% of the total. I mean, if you look at the underfunded mandate, and obviously that's dollars that should be there that aren't there. And then the actual underlying obligation to the state that is, from the state that is funded, those are real dollars. And they will accrue immediately back to the agency to be used to help fund the rest of their unfunded mandate. So it actually makes the fund more solid. It isn't an original idea. It may not even be a brilliant idea. It's just a good, solid way to save some money. And the interesting thing about it is, in talking to the co-chairs, they're already looking at the beneficial effect that the estimated $3.3 million will have in helping to handle our PERS obligations. You know, it isn't the big solution. It isn't the $6 million or $6 billion trimming of the obligations. But then again, it's, as the chairman of the first committee in the Senate said, it's probably the only first bill you'll put out the session that you won't have a lawsuit on. Probably not going to get litigated on this one. And I do want to thank the folks from PERS for helping me explore this concept. It was originally vetted almost a year and a half ago. And then we worked through the possibilities. We still have a lot of things that we need logistically to do, and that's why the window is perfected. The interesting thing is we don't even know all of the people that hold the PERS accounts. We don't know where they are. We get 16,000 of them of the 45,000 that this bill works at, who never were vested. and we're holding onto their money for 5 years, and we'd love to send it back to them. We just don't know where they are, because things change and people move. You got to go find them, and that's why this bill has administrative overheads involved. The other thing is we've got to look at the other roughly 39,000 account holders and probably contact them and make them an offer and say, look, if you take your money out now, you may have some options. And we're not going to counsel these folks about their options. We're just going to say they can get 150% of their base. Some of them will be able to roll it over into a retirement program. So they will leave our system and may have no tax consequences at all if they roll it over. Others will have a tax consequence, and that's why the multiplier is there. So essentially they can get the contribution that they made, they'll have to pay the taxes on. And that will net them approximately what they have in the account as their own contributions. Most folks may do a little better than that. But the state certainly will save some money, and that's what the bill's about. So if there's any questions, I'll try and defer them all to my colleague from VERS, who really understands what this thing does.
I was at a town hall recently, and I met a public employee who thought I was doing an incredibly good job. I had lost confidence in the rest of you, however.
Yeah.
And
thanks, Mom, to the beginning of the interview.
But needless to say, was concerned about what was happening with PERS. And this person wasn't inactive; they were active, currently working. They wanted the ability to get out as well. Has that possibility been explored?
The way this bill is constructed, it really only affects inactive vested members. And I guess I would argue to you is this is either going to get a good solid response from people or it will be slightly underwhelming. If it gets a good solid response from people, I would urge folks to explore the issue of possibly expanding to just a straight buyout program. But, you know, this is going to take time to set up. We don't know what the success ratio will be. I agree with the idea that a currently vested inactive member over the age of 50 is going to probably think hard about this because it's not that far to retirement. So I think there will be a tail off at some certain age. Although if we keep mucking about with PERS, maybe it's a huge incentive for people to take their money and run. This is a great little test case. It doesn't cost you a lot. It may save some money. And I also have a feeling that these dollars that are saved are going to pop up somewhere else in the budget as being necessary revenues to balance the system out. And, but vested inactive members are the only targets of this legislation today.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, as I look at the bill, it says an inactive member who withdraws the account, and although we would intend that they would have the ability to roll it over, I'm concerned that the IRS may view this as being a withdrawal and not allow them to roll it over unless there might be an amendment where we'd add a clause saying or roll it over into a qualified plan or something like that. I'm wondering if one that should be added just to make sure there's no question that they would have the ability to roll it over. And the second is its effective date is July 1, 2004. And it is such a good idea. I'm wondering if how you feel about it being moved up to an earlier date.
Well, let me give you two answers. I mean, I'll try to answer the first part of the question. We assumed that this would create a taxable event. So that's why the 150% is the number, the multiplier. But we didn't want to assume so completely that we didn't also assume there were some people who had different tax situations that could structure a rollover rather than a taxable event. So we just left that open, assuming it was a taxable event. So I don't know if there's somebody smart enough to figure out how to roll these over into an approval system. That, you know, that would be another inducement as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it would.
So perhaps my colleague has an answer for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, use of the term withdrawal, I believe, is consistent with the current statute. On the withdrawal of member accounts, and those are rolled over now frequently. So I'm assuming that there's no issue there. And beyond that, withdrawal from a 401A plan, which is what taxpayers is by federal law rollable. So I think that would supersede it too. So I think we're doubly protected there, that people would be able to roll these dollars.
And Mr. Chairman, to the questioner, Representative Richardson, I think we're safer if we make no representations in that regard. If they're rollable, they are, and that would be up to the individual to seek that opportunity. The other issue was about the date. We did deal a great deal with the PERS infrastructure and staff in trying to figure out how long it would take them to build the system, get the database, find these people, send them the letter, have a reasonable response period, and then start the program. So we put it off far enough so that we thought they could, PERS folks could actually do those logistical things. And we figured about a year to get the program up and running. And to do it earlier may save more, but it would also cost you more because PERS would have to respond faster. So that, you know, we're trying to figure out what the balance point is to get the job done and do it well and do it responsibly. Not sort of continuously stress PERS to the breaking point, the personnel there. Have a reasonable chance of making an offer to all of the 45,000 vested and active members. Clear out the 16,000 that are, you know, not vested in active. I mean, that to me seems just bizarre that we would keep their money for 5 years. Why don't we just 90 days and give them their money and send them on their way? But those things take time, and that's why we picked the dates that we did. That's why we also structured the window that we did. But, you know, I think we've probably tried to do what seems most reasonable to make this offer. I've had people come up to me and say, what are you out of your mind, giving them 150% of what they offered? And I thought, well, you know, when the obligation, if they retire, first trustees retire, and I'm one of them, wait till full retirement age, then they have 17 different options, and one of them is the money match, and that's the expensive one. But that's not, I mean, that's one real aspect. The other aspect is just the guarantee. You know, no other program pays that kind of a guarantee. And this allows us, at least for a few people, to give them an option. Maybe they can do it tax-free. Certainly it cuts our costs. Maybe they have other needs for the funds as well. Seems like a good idea.
Other questions? Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson.
Senator Farioli, I want to compliment you on an imaginative approach and one that works with voluntary action, which I think is always desirable when we're working in this area where we otherwise have a dynamic which is not as voluntary and has a lot of tensions built into it as a result. What I wanted to explore is, to what extent does the fiscal analysis reflect the, and I realize it's quite recent action, on House Bill 2003, which, you know, the sort of basic dynamic there is that we're recognizing that too much was credited to member accounts in the strong market years of 1996 through 1999, and in order to right the system to reflect that overcrediting, we're going to have the Tier 1 member accounts at a zero crediting rate for several years until the deficit that was created in the reserve account is replenished at a positive earnings. That's the one of the key aspects of that bill is that dynamic. So what's happening here is a member who is inactive, and we'll assume that's a Tier 1 a member with a regular account that would have been expecting at least an 8% return, instead is going to be at a 0% return for several years, waiting, in effect, the positive earnings on that being then used to fill in the deficit. And I'm just wondering whether we're creating a situation here where nothing you could have anticipated when you introduced the bill, but that in the interaction between those two bills, assuming House Bill 2003 is passed, enacted into law, where members will have an additional incentive to take this option because they can then get the 150% of their account and not have the in effect, zero return that will exist for several years while we recover the overcrediting of the late 1990s. To what extent has that entered into your thinking or the analysis that has been done of the fiscal impact?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure complicated, really simple idea. Well, we actually did think of some of those things. First of all, I'll point out that this bill is in co-evolution with the others. That, you know, they're all being done in concert with PERS and in consultation with PERS. Depending on what the earnings are from the restoration fund, it could be 2097 before all those dollars are paid back into the to fund, so that we end up with distribution amounts that are like the contractual amounts. I don't know about that. You know, I don't know if anybody can really tell you how long it's going to take to do the restoration of those distributions that we could call over, you know, from the superheated economy that were over allocated to earnings. But in point of fact, the people that are vested in PERS that are not currently employed are making no contributions to the system. They're not helping to add anything to carry their weight. They have a fixed asset, they earn it at a fixed rate, and they can continue to do that virtually until retirement. So the fact is that the rest of the system is carrying the burden. And really, it'd be better for the system in order to be able to just shed its burden. We also know that there are a certain number of people out there, they're a small minority, that would have been planning to pull out of the system for their own personal reasons anyway. And we discussed it. In other words, there's a certain measurable percentage of PERS vestees at whatever period they are in their lives that pull out. And if they do that today without the benefit of this bill, they not only get only access to what they've contributed, but is there a penalty for withdrawal there? No, there's no penalty. But they certainly couldn't get any more than they had contributed because they're vested, but they don't have access to the money match or any of the other retirement benefits. They would just withdraw what they had. So some of those people are obviously going to have a 50% windfall. Is there going to do it in? So we thought about that. We thought about the effect of other bills on PERS. Retirees and vestees. We know that many of the folks that are not currently employed are not going to make, cannot make, would not be allowed to make additional contributions. So they only have an account that earns interest, and that's what's costing us money. And if they hold it long enough, we have to double the contribution that we have made to grow their account. Because remember, they can't make contributions after they sever from the state. So we're going to be paying interest on interest and then doubling that. So I guess there is some interaction issues. There are some folks that are going to have a windfall. But on balance, this saves money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Other quick, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, you keep saying their contributions. You're talking about the whole account, I'm assuming.
Mr. Chairman, when folks are working, obviously, you know, there's a variety of different agreements that they work under, but they make employee contributions. They may be paid by the employer, they may be paid by the employee, or a combination. And I'm looking at the monthly amount that goes for that employee into that employee's account. You know, I consider that to be the contribution. What's underlying that is the obligation that's unfunded for the money match at the end of the retirement, plus the cost of living increases and the distributions on top of it. So when all those dollars are coming from agencies and earnings, not from the employee. So at some point in time, like, I'll give you for instance, this is an eerie coincidence. Today I received my PERS account statement. I was an employee of the state of Oregon for a period of time. I worked for the Department of Veterans Affairs about 7 years. It was, I think, 1984 in that period. I worked long enough to have made employee contributions of about $7,500 into my PERS account. Today the face value is $85,000. I have not been subject to PERS until I was elected to the legislature in 1996. So I hadn't worked for a state employee or a state-affiliated employment for 20-plus years, and in that time, that account went from $7,000 to what it is today is $85,000. And the amount that I make in contribution to that account, you're very familiar with, because it's probably the same amount that you make in contribution, since our wages and salaries are the same at the legislature, whether we're House or Senate members. So my contribution since I've been a member of the legislature has been less than $3,000, yet my balance is over $85,000. Pretty good deal, man. But the point is, that's why the vested employees or the non-affiliated vestees need to be offered an incentive to leave the system. So there. Hope that answers your question.
That pretty much says there are cases where that money is split. People do other systems and they say the employer, there might be a piece of the account that was actually paid by the employer goes somewhere else, and that's in an unusual circumstance when they come to report on police and fire and ask to be accepted into that. They only take the money the employee, not the employer's portion, actually put in that is sent out the door that same month.
I do not pretend to understand the complexity of the PERS system, but what I do know is that each employee in the PERS system gets an annual statement, and that basically is the amount that is in their investment in the system.
And what is, if I may ask, and you certainly don't have to answer, but when they give that to you, they also say, if you retire at age 55, this is how much you'll get a month.
Oh, sure. At least they used to.
Yeah.
I look at the big number and figure what the heck.
Not this year.
The first statements this year don't have that on there, and that's a good thing. Because I think people took those as sort of promises.
Yeah.
Right.
For some strength.
Well, they may be, in fact, contractual obligations, and won't that be an interesting lawsuit? But let me just remind the committee that this isn't some nefarious scheme to trip people or trick them out of the system. There's been a continuous discussion about folks nearing retirement age should think very hard about this. This is, in fact, just an effort to offer those people who would want out of this system or could be incented out of the system because of the additional dollars to leave it, and the clear benefit is to the state. Now there may be a co-benefit to the vestee, and I hope we're disclosing this fairly. We're asking people to voluntarily leave the system, and if they do, they get a premium. It should be a very straightforward transaction.
Other questions? Representative McPherson.
I just did some simple math here, Senator, and this is very rudimentary, but if I had a $100,000 account, and under this bill I would get $150,000 if I availed myself of this, if I were eligible as an inactive member, and if I assumed that if House Bill 2003 is enacted into law, and if I assumed that the earnings were going to be suspended on my Tier 1 member account for 5 years, even at just a 6% return, if I assumed I was going to earn 6% a year with the money I took out, I would have more than $200,000 at the end of 5 years. So my concern, it goes back to the question I asked earlier, is that I think the concept is sound. I'm just concerned in the interaction between the two bills that the quantity of 150% isn't right. That we are creating an incentive for people to opt for this option just because of the interaction between those two bills, and that perhaps a fairer kind of balance between sort of the incentive that we're and then the savings we're trying to achieve might be something less than 150%. And I'm just wondering whether you're open to that kind of an analysis.
Yeah, I think that we did a great deal of noodling on what is a reasonable incentive. And we started with no sideboards at all. The sales resistance drops as the percentage goes up. And obviously the sales resistance increases as the incentive goes down. The issue for me is, if I could take $150,000 and invest it in real estate, what would it be worth in 5 years? So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is that the incentive will be different for each individual person. Their analysis will be individual to their circumstances. Some people will need to take the money, whether there was a premium or not. others will see that by leaving they'll be earning more than if they weren't by staying. I think that's your point exactly. We want them to leave. We want them to have an incentive. Other folks, like myself, will probably stay in the system until they boot us out of it when we hit retirement age 65.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But the thing I want to focus in on, though, is that I'm assuming that the analysis you're describing that you went through was before House Bill 2003 was amended and moved out of the House.
So
I'm assuming that analysis was just an analysis based on the assumption that these accounts would otherwise be earning at an 8% return or more, or probably after House Bill 2001 at an 8% return. That assumption now is not a sound assumption, assuming House Bill 2003 is enacted. So the question I have is, are you open to a reanalysis of whether the 150% is the right quantity to provide the appropriate incentive balanced with savings?
Mr. Chairman, this bill exists at the pleasure of your committee, so it's less important whether I'm open to negotiation or reconsideration as it is whether you are.
Okay.
And I guess what I'd ask the good representative, Mr. Chairman, is, you play poker?
Rarely.
All right. I wish we had an odds maker here, because I would ask him, what are the odds of Senate Bill 2003 withstanding court challenge? And how long will that take? Will it be 3 years in the courts, or will an expedited decision be made in just a year and a half? Will all the other aspects of our remaking of the birth system withstand court challenges? I don't know. Will the courts uphold parts, because we put severability clauses into these bills, will they uphold parts of these bills and say that, well, no, you can limit to 8% because that was the contractual, that was the assumptive agreement, or that was the implied contract. So you're going to have to rethink the issue of trying to refund the over-generous distributions in some other manner at over 8%. I mean, the average earnings for the last 5 years have been 12.87 or something quite a bit greater than 8%. So I don't know if we can answer those questions. I certainly don't have any objection to people getting a fine point pencil out and trying to refigure the what is reasonable given all of the assumptions, but I don't know which assumptions you keep and which ones you throw out. So, you know, at the end of the day, what I was thinking about was, at 150%, we're doing a little better than zeroing out most people's tax liability on their own accrual. And some of them will be willing and able to roll it over. And so that is a pretty good incentive to move out of the system. And that's what I'm after. It's a pretty good incentive. Not everybody will take it. Refiguring it at 135%, I don't have any objection to that. I think that the committee wishes to do that. Simply accept the fact that fewer people will be incented to leave the system. And so the savings will drop. I am utterly amazed at the alchemy that happens in legislative fiscal. They've got an estimate of $3.382 million in the savings for 2003-2005 and a similar amount for 2005-2007, and the costs drop off to zero in 2005. I don't know what their analysis would be or what their basis for calculation is, but the rest of state government is based on it, or whatever it is, because we rely on these fiscal analysis for everything we do. So I would just urge you, if you're going to reformulate this, to think hard about what you're really trying to achieve, and that's 45,000 accounts. People are not vested. We'd like them to take their money and do with it what they will. But we know that if we keep their money, we're going to owe approximately twice what we owe when these people retire. That's a certainty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Anyone else?
Thank you very much, Senator.
My objective, Mr. Chair, was to lull everyone into almost somnambulistic. I think this is a good idea. I hope I was able to answer your questions.
And you had 27 votes in the Senate?
Yeah.
With three people gone.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the I presented the bill in lots less words than I used here, because I've been talking to folks about this bill in the Senate for 2 years. I'm sick of hearing about it. The good senator from Cottage Grove stood up and he only said, this is the only first bill in this legislature and you won't get sued on. We got all of them.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 258A?
Brian DeLargement, I guess I'm representing the First Coalition. We're fine with this bill. Just a little history. Actually, Senator Ferrioli approached me with this idea, I think during the third special session. I think it was actually the second special session. He had a concept. We worked on it, came to the form it's in now, have stuck with it. We think it still has some validity, even with interrelationship with the other bills. We were involved all the way along in the drafting and the window opportunity piece. The you have to be out of the system, have been out of the system prior to 2000. We've talked to some of our past members about this. Some are interested and we'll have to do some penciling on this, and some say, well, I'm going to stick around. I'm already at 52 years old and I've got 3 more years and I'll just go out to the normal system. But I think regardless of the question that Representative McPherson asked about the 8% crediting, I think one of the values of this is there's not the 2% COLA. So you're getting these people out rather than paying a monthly benefit to them at the end, and then they've got the 2% COLA indefinitely. There's definitely a savings there. So regardless of whether it's crediting at the 8% and that holds up or not, or 2003, at some point, 2003 does not disallow even the COLA. I mean, it may pull it in advance for a while, but the COLA then kicks in. And so this is, in essence, the same thing as somebody taking the double lump sum at retirement. You get them out as an incentive not have to pay the COLA. Well, you do this at this point, there's an advantage to them. In some cases, there's an advantage to the system. So we're fine with the bill.
Fran, what's the dynamic if you offered this to active vesteds?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was one of the conversations that I can recall that we actually had with Senator Ferrioli and some of the First Coalition at that time. We're not excited about that as a concept because I guess I hate to say this in the way I'm going to say it, but I'll be very straightforward with you. I think sometimes you have to try and protect some people from their own folly. And I think you would have people with instability and PERS panicking, quitting their public employment, and taking the money and running. And I think that would be a very unfortunate situation. So I guess my answer to you is, let's do this step, see how it does or doesn't work. If there's some other things that we can do down the road in a couple of years dealing with buyouts, we could explore that. But I think this is the right step to take now. But I think with the instability in the PERS system right now, I think you would have some people panic. And I think, unfortunately, they would regret their decisions in a very short order after putting their employment and taking the quick money.
Questions for Brian?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Manton from the City of Portland. I just want a few comments on Senator Ferrioli's bill. It's a good bill with a good concept. The original idea, as it was put forward over a year ago, never foresaw any of the things we see in 2003, actually, just foresaw the system as it is today. And I think that Representative McPherson had a very good point there. When you start throwing the dynamics of what happens with the 8%, it will have a substantial change on the way people view this bill. Of course, we have to take into account also that many people are not going to understand those dynamics, even when they're presented to them. It's going to be a very complicated issue for them at that point. With that said, it is not a bad idea. I don't think that many people are going to go out on Money Match that are currently in the system because they're going to start to be frozen. Their 8% will be frozen going forward. It's going to push more people back into, as we see with everybody else, back into the formula. At a formula rate, there's less of a savings for employers on this one, because you're really contemplating many people going out on the money match and taking out that double and 150% match is really what it comes out to be. Because not only do you have the COLAs, you have, in future, at age 65, their health benefit that will be added on top of that. And for people who have a small pension moving forward, that $60 a month is actually a substantial benefit moving forward. So we get the added benefit of those two pieces going away. So I have no real conceptual idea of how much money would be saved, but the 2003 will change this one substantially, and it may in fact be a better idea to have it as a... The risk going forward, as I was trying to contemplate it, for somebody who wants to pull their money out, as they were talking about, if, as Representative McPherson says, you could get 6% and you move forward with it, versus keeping it in right now and not getting the 8% at all, so it should have a real dynamic effect on your thought processes of what you wanted to do. And so it may push the risk of what you want to give them back and put it at like a, maybe 130%, where your meeting point gets to be in terms of what you want to give and receive. I don't know if you want to amend the bill. I don't know how long it would take to run computations on something like that, but it seems to me that those two factors are going to start to weigh in there somewhere pretty strongly. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, question?
And I don't know, Mr. Mann, if this question belongs to you or to Mr. Bailey. This discussion about interaction between this bill and House Bill 2003, have you thought through the fact that in this bill we're talking about the eligibility not occurring until at least a year after 2003 is in effect, which means people will have already foregone a year of earnings crediting. So it seems to me, as you think through that, that nullifies a good bit of the issue that you're concerned about, because they'll already have to wait through a year of zero earnings in order to be eligible for this, in order to be able to exercise their option under this.
Chair, Representative Nolan, I was thinking more of people who were going to do 3 or 4 or 5 years out, as Representative McPherson had talked about, who have to make that decision now, as opposed to, you know, they may not be able to retire for 3 or 4 or 5 years versus taking their money right now. And you'd have foregone 1 year, yes. Do you forego more than 1 year after that? Everybody's going to forego that 1 year. That's just the case.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
My reading of the bill, though, is that it is pretty narrowly drafted in terms of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
People who retire this year aren't eligible. They have to be in inactive status as of January 1, 2000. So it won't affect anyone who's currently active in deciding whether to take take advantage of this because they're not eligible. It's people who are, I mean, it's just accounts that are sitting there, right, as Mr. Bailey pointed out, accruing earnings but having no contribution from the employee going in there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I was aware of that. I just meant that all members, inactive and active, will not get the 8%
right,
if 2003 goes through.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question? Yeah, just stay there, Stephen. I'm going to sort of think out loud here a little bit, and I think Representative Nolan makes a very good point that actually a year and a half of earnings will be foregone at a minimum by the people who are in this group. So that's 12% that they will have foregone out of the 8% assumed interest rate applied to those accounts. And with respect to, in response to the point that Senator Farioli made, which is that there's uncertainty about whether 2003 will be approved by the, upheld by the Supreme Court, but the probability is that issue will be resolved by the time this takes effect. So the area of uncertainty about that will have been in all probability laid to rest at the time that people would have this choice available to them. So they will know whether or not that suspension of the 8% applies to their account in all probability. Who knows how quickly the Supreme Court will act. So I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm just wondering what the right process is to try to get a handle on
on what the right, whether a 25% discount from two times the account is the right amount, considering, as Representative Nolan very well points out, that there's a 12% element that is already built in structurally to the decision. And I just would appreciate any thoughts you have on that, if there's anything useful to offer.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I actually believe that there's a prorated 8% through to July 1 if the bill 2003 is set for July 1 enactment date. Am I not? Isn't that the date that we had?
No, I believe that's not the case. That is, that there's no, if for people who retire here during this year, there will be a prorated application. But for people who leave after February 1 of 2004, whose retirement dates are after that date, they would get no, there'd be no earnings credit for calendar year 2003, mm-hmm. as opposed to a prorated adjustment for an.
Yeah,
I believe that's the case.
My only thought was that because there is risk out there for the Supreme Court decision, however this may fall, that if you were going to assume a risk at this date or the date when it could go forward, and you had to make an assumption there, then if you did not know the Supreme Court decision, you may want to take your money, but you may want to give them a reduced risk on it. In other words, a reduced reward, not a reduced risk, but something to 130%. But if the decision is known, then it once again throws in. There's a whole lot of different pieces in this. It's an interesting bill. It's a very good concept. There's a lot of factors out there that are going to change how people will act on this once it is enacted, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 258A? Seeing no one else, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, I'm open to taking this to work session. Just want to get everybody's thoughts before we kind of get a sense of the committee. People are comfortable or?
I have a question. I'm concerned about the assumption that this is going to be tax qualified for rollovers. And I'd like to know what you think.
I think it will be eligible for rollover. The tax rules on distributions from tax-qualified plans are quite expansive as to what kinds of distributions from plans are eligible for rollover. There are a few narrow carve-outs, this kind of distribution wouldn't fall into any that I can recall off the top of my head. So I think that these will be rollable. So if people want to take this money and roll it over into an IRA, I think they'll have the opportunity to do that.
Cheapest legal opinion you ever got.
Yeah.
I'm going to open a work session because we're going to have some more input. So,
Mr. Chair, if I may, I believe Representative McPherson is correct, and I just talked to Dave Bailey. This is no different than the lump sum or the double lump sum at retirement, in which that, in fact, is rollable. So this is just a lump sum and a half partway through prior to your retirement. It's no different than single lump sum or double lump sum at retirement, and that's rollable currently under the PERS system.
Yeah, I don't sense that there's any question at all about whether or not this can be rolled over tax free.
You don't think there is a question?
I don't believe so.
I mean,
as far as we can tell, we believe that to be the case, and PERS believes that to be the case. I mean, we could get more tax attorneys in here, but
Mr. Chairman,
on that point, I think it's useful for us to offer opinions about it. I concur with Senator Farioli, though, that it is a little dangerous for us to declare intentions that might potentially become obligations. The danger is that they do not prove to be true, and for us to be on record as saying that we think this is rollable. I would be leery of putting anything on record with respect to our intent on that, because I don't want us to be liable for that opinion, since it is not thoroughly investigated. It's experts, but it's off the cuff without detailed examination.
Given the legal minefield that we walk in Burr's legislation, I think that Representative Nolan's point is well taken, that whatever views are offered up here, I think they should be taken just as that they were drawing on our sort of collective knowledge, but that this bill says these are distributable and people can roll them over to the extent that they conclude that they're able to roll them over.
Okay.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, while I believe that it probably is subject to being rolled over, a large portion of that is based upon federal law, which is subject to change frequently. And I wouldn't want the record to reflect, but that's why we were doing this, was anticipating that folks would be able to enjoy some special income tax benefit, which is based upon federal tax law that we have very little or no control over. So I think it's wise to stay off the record, and those folks can sort it out. While I would have no problem in my current tax or in my tax practice for taking these and picking them up and holding by the four corners under the current federal law, I wouldn't want forever anyone to take a look at this legislation and say, seven or eight people sat at a dais one time and said they thought we could get forever some sort of a tax benefit out of it. I don't want to go there. So I feel pretty strongly that we just take it by the four corners and do what we need to do with it here without expressing any federal tax or any of the implications for income tax purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson.
The reason I brought this up to begin with was to not allow ambiguities to remain if they could be avoided by adding a clause or two, such as maybe or who withdraws either in lump sum or by rolling over to a qualified or IRA or something like, where there could be specific language that would allow a tax preparer or practitioners to use that language in trying to justify a tax return. And so when we say who withdraws, we are leaving it completely ambiguous, and it's okay to do that, but I don't know if it's wise to do that if we could avoid a problem for a person who's going to take advantage of this by spelling out a little bit more specifically what we meant by withdrawal. And we're not making any guarantees, but certainly we have the option of adding language if that would be advisable. That's the reason I thought.
Representative Barker?
I would get a tax attorney's opinion. I think it's rollable, but what do I know? And what do we know? Representative McPherson knows, but he's even hesitating. So,
I think it's rollable, but I think Representative Nolan's point is a controlling one, which is that it's not our part here on this committee or the as a legislative body to be offering up tax advice. And I think we ought to structure this the same way we do any of the distributions. And then what happens is the PERS agency then has certain notice obligations it has to the members, and it will conclude within the all the time and process that it needs to in order to fulfill those notice obligations under federal law as to whether or not it's rollable. I think that aspect of the bill is not something I would be concerned about. My only concern about the bill is whether the quantity is right, about whether 150%, given the interactions with House Bill 2003, and the uncertainties about House Bill 2003 that have been voiced by folks who, in all sincerity, believe that we've overstepped our bounds and will be asking the Supreme Court to reverse that, whether that's the right quantity. And I would be more comfortable if I saw if there had been more specific economic analysis of the interactions, taking into account that it would be at least, I believe, a 12% discount that even the people who opted on July 1 of 2004 to take their money would be undergoing. And it may be that the analysis is that that's the right quantity, still 150% net savings, and it's the right kind of balance. But I don't feel that confidence at this moment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Allen.
Seems to me that it isn't the purview of this committee to offer tax advice to any individuals or to groups of individuals. Seems to me the question for us on this bill is whether the policy of trying to reduce the obligations of the PERS system is appropriately met by this piece of legislation. The analysis that was done suggests that there would be savings to the system, which I think is a good thing. Whether that analysis would benefit from a reexamination in the light of House Bill 2003, I don't know. But I doubt that it would diminish the savings that could be accumulated here. Whether we could achieve those same savings by reducing the incentive to inactive members, I think, is the question that Representative McPherson asks. And I don't know if legislative fiscal or the actuary would be in a position to offer different assumptions. They've made some assumptions about who would take advantage of this. Presumably the assumptions would be that fewer people would take advantage of it if we reduced the incentive. If there were a steeper discount, presumably fewer people would take advantage of it. That means the system would retain a 200% obligation to those people who would not take this buyout offer. And my gut tells me that it would actually reduce the savings because fewer people would be removed and the system would eventually owe them 200% instead of 150%. But if we have time and leisure to have it reexamined, we could do that.
Mr. Chair, the analysis you have to go through is much like the pricing decisions that a retailer goes through when mm-hmm. pricing merchandise. Mm-hmm. That is your sale pricing a piece of merchandise, and you have to judge by cutting the price how much more product will you move.
Exactly.
That's the kind of it's a very interactive and ultimately to some extent unknowable kind of analysis that one has to pursue. And I don't pretend that we're going to achieve any certainty in the end. I just I'm concerned, for example, that the fiscal analysis we have here, which I see is dated April 15, that was before House Bill 2003 was actively considered with the, in fact, I think it was before the initial presentation on the amendments that we ultimately put into House Bill 2003. So by its date, it's just on its face, we can tell it was not done with House Bill 2003 in view. So I would feel much more comfortable acting on Senate Bill 258 if we at least ask the question of legislative fiscal to go back and work through that process again and just test the assumptions they went through and then bring the bill back. And if we decide that, yeah, based on what we can tell, we still think 150% is the right quantity, then so be it. But if we were to propose some lesser percentage, I would just be picking a number. I'd just be shooting at something in the dark. And I'd like to have a little more method by which one we arrive at whatever that quantity is. And it may be that after that further analysis, 150% still seems like the right amount.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Looking at the fiscal impact statement, LFO assumed that only 10% of eligible members would take advantage of this. So if we reduce the incentive that they have, we may still get 10%, but I doubt that there's a whole lot we can do to goose that up.
Mr. Chair, but the comparison, though, to the alternative to taking this option at 150% is under House Bill 2003 completely different. I mean, under this analysis assumed an account that was rising by 8% per year and how many people would choose to take it, whereas we're assuming the enactment of House Bill 2003, we've got then an account that is going to be level without any increase for several years. And so the alternative is completely different. And so I would say that if we left it at 150%, the assumption would have to be that
far more people would choose to take this option because of just the rough analysis I was going through in my calculator. Somebody thinks, well, you know, if they don't need the money now, they think about what could I earn on that money if I can take this money that's going to be held without earnings for several years, roll it over to an IRA and get positive earnings on it. What do I think I can earn on it, and how does that compare? So I think that if we don't adjust downward the 150% quantity, we would have to assume substantially greater utilization than the 10% that is in this fiscal analysis. How much more, I have no idea. But then, of course, the issue would be, okay, if we assume much more than 10%, if we assume 20% or 30% or more would utilize it, then what is the savings as compared to having that money sitting without earnings for several years? And then the next step of the analysis is how much would we, if we were to reduce the premium paid at from 150 to 140 or 130, then how much would that cut back into the utilization? That's the kind of analysis that needs to be done.
David, can you come back up? Did you guys use the commonly known standard in accounting, PFA standard, pluck from error? I mean, it's hard. I'm looking at this and thinking, I mean, how do we know 10%? How do we know 20%? How do we know? I don't think you really do know. And I don't know what standard you would apply other than the PFA standard, which is you gotta pick a number and say, well, based on the 150%, you know, and the standards and the things that are around in the system right now and maybe some of the uncertainty, although there may be more uncertainty after 2003 or the fact that the bill's moving than there was before. But can you give me an idea? Because you guys obviously were the ones that came to get the fiscal. So I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Dave Bailey with PERS. The fiscal is not based on much except what you said, just picking what we thought was reasonable at the time. And I would recommend that some additional actuarial analysis would be prudent because we didn't consider the impacts of House Bill 2003 at the time that we looked at this. I think that there's the question that I have is there's no question in my mind that there's countervailing impacts probably from 2003 and this bill. This bill would remove the requirement that you match these members' accounts at retirement, which generates savings. On the other hand, it takes dollars out of the system, which would potentially earn money, which would not go to the members' accounts, but would go to reducing the unfunded actuarial liability. So which of those would dominate in the analysis, I don't know, and I think it's worthwhile to take a look at that.
Okay. Could you have that done by Thursday?
Actually, possibly. I don't see it as hugely complicated, but okay. We'll see.
My members, what do you think? Hold it over till Thursday? I'm seeing some nods. Yes. Okay. We can do that. Why don't we, anything else? Why don't we close the work session on Senate Bill 258A? And was anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 325A? John, were you here for that one, or possibly?
Chairman, I guess I could
be responsible. Okay. I don't see Senator Nelson. Was he? Why don't we
head it east from or at least find out his whereabouts?
Well, is he waiting? Okay, we'll stand at ease until we get Senator Nelson down here for Senate Bill 325A. first committee back to order and welcome Senator Nelson. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 325A. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from Hamilton. I represent four counties out in Eastern Oregon, Unitilla, Morrow, Union, and Wallowa counties. And Senate Bill 325, as amended, has come to us and requested a lot of help from folks in our counties that have public employees. We don't have large populations. Like the largest city in my district is Felton. There's not only 15,000 people. I have 28 cities, and I kept about 22 school districts and several hospitals. And all these folks out there are hurting for people to work. We just don't have a critical mass in which to employ people. And so when these people retire, they'd still like to continue to work. They have a lot of skill and ability that they've accumulated over the years, and they do a very important thing, and that is, particularly in the education field, is that they bring some stability to the system. They also help these school districts get through some of their financial crises, because when they come back, as I understand, they don't have to pay some of the PERS benefits and the health benefits and things of that nature. So this bill started out, at first, just as for one of my municipal fellow wanted to work in the prisons in the Unitilla area. And then there are the schools over in Milton Freewater got involved in it, and we just have problems keeping people working in these, staying in these areas and working. And so we have a -7 amendment that I'm going to propose to you also. And on page 1, line 18, it deletes not more than 35,000, inserts fewer than 75,000. The reason for that is that it includes Unitilla County, because it has a population of around 60,000 people. But a fair amount of small schools and small institutions. And then on line 4, which would be the limitations, goes to a nurse educator if the nurse educator is employed by a community college with a population of fewer than 75,000. So it does really benefit Unitilla County more than anything else. But we just feel like it's a practical solution to a really dire situation in our part of the country. So I would ask your support on that. If I can answer some questions, I'd be more than happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, would you say again, maybe you already mentioned this and I didn't catch it, but how many counties are there that this would apply to?
Well, this probably only applies to Unitilla County because it's less than 75,000 population, in my district anyway. And the rest of the state, I think Pelton's in kind of a unique area. I think it may end up including more counties in this thing. That's something I'm not sure. We'll have to ask somebody else. I don't know if anybody here in the district or anybody in the room has some idea what that is, but I don't really know.
Well, there's a heck of a lot of counties in Oregon that are less than 75,000. Pretty near every county in Eastern Oregon would qualify.
I think with the exception of Deschutes, every county in Eastern Oregon.
Well, the bill was before less than 35,000, just about every county in Eastern Oregon.
So
covered by that. Yeah. The other three counties in my district were covered by 33,000.
I suspect most of the coastal counties would also qualify under this bill.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson, you want to continue? Did you have an...
I have some concerns. In fact, let me go ahead and bring it up, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, my concern is that there are in every city and every county of the state this year hundreds, thousands of employees that are retiring because they want to take advantage of the PERS situation and continuing to work, double dipping essentially, where they'll retire on a Friday and they'll go to work on Monday getting 200% of their wages, 100 or better, because the average now is over 100% for PERS retirement benefits plus their full salary, 100% of that salary, and so they're going to end up with earning 200 plus percent for the same job, the same time, their employer's no longer paying into the PERS system, so that's thwarting part of the funding for PERS system, and they're not retiring, and so that means that that job that would have been available for other people to move up to, or for people coming out of college or coming out of high school to move into, we have, you know, this high unemployment rate, and we have this tremendous number of jobs that could be coming available for people to move into, and it seems to me that we are hurting ourselves while we are helping in a few limited circumstances where there's absolutely just nobody to do the work. Like, I was talking with Representative Butler about the graders in some very rural part of the state where they just can't get somebody who can occasionally come to work there. But for many areas, this is being used as a way to save on PERS payments, but it's really detrimental to the economy as I see it. And so that's a concern I have.
Okay, I can appreciate that. I guess my answer to that would be is like in most of these areas, you don't have that huge demand of people wanting to move in and live and work. And that's the crucial issue that we're trying to address here is that we just can't find the people.
Okay. Chair, Senator, concern that maybe it's because there's no jobs in those areas. And if there were decent paying jobs, which PERS employers certainly have, possibly, they could be recruited in many instances. I mean, maybe not in all, but in many instances. And
I think it's balancing that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's when I've talked to the superintendents on my part of the country who used this under the 35,000 rule last year, it was very successful. And the other thing, it was very good for the students also, because the students got the benefit of an experienced teacher. So, I mean, that is a balancing act. There's no question about it. I was just handed this this sheet that indicates that there would be 7 counties affected by this law. Umatilla at 71,000, Klamath, Polk, Coos, Lincoln, Columbia, and Clatsop. 6, I guess. 7. No, that's 7. There is 7 there. Now here at 32,000 was already under the...
Was already included, right.
Was already included. And then Telemec, Union, Wasco, Curry, Hood River, Crook, Jefferson, Baker, Morrow, Grant, Harney, Lake, Wallowa, Gillen, Sherman, and Wheeler were all under the old 35,000. That's the popular side with this. But it's just, from my viewpoint, it's just another tool to allow these counties to get... Some benefit out of this, and like Josephine, Benton, Yamhill, Douglas, Land, the shoots were not. But it's really the populated areas that really help. But when you go, Umatilla, Klamath, Polk, and Coos all have 60,000 between 60 and 70, and then you drop way down to 45,000. And so I can appreciate your concerns. I just people aren't moving into our area. It'd be different if we had big timber industries going in these places where you have vibrant communities, but you've got in my part of the country and those communities are dying. People aren't going back there to live. They're just not there. Because you just, I mean, the jobs might be there, but if kids start moving away, then, classes get smaller. It's a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. So what this is really just an opportunity for these counties to be able to use existing resources. They're desperate times, there's no question.
Follow up? Then maybe it's a 75,000 figure that's a problem. Representative Verger said that in Coos Bay, which certainly would be affected by this, that I believe she said the school superintendent, the police chief, and I think it was the fire chief are all retiring within the next 2 months and all are staying on the job. Mm-hmm. And Klamath Falls certainly is, there are lots of people that live there and move there, and with more job availability, it would be beneficial for them. And so if it was 35,000 maximum before, and that would serve your needs, why would it be necessary to increase it to 75,000? That would bring in other areas which basically are just allowing to double dip unlimited.
Well, if you look at all these counties, these are basically rural counties. I mean, Klamath County, Klamath Falls is one large city, probably 15,000 people. You know, Keller, we have the 2 large cities, Pelton and Hermiston, 15,000 people. Every one of these are really small cities that people aren't living there. People aren't going there. They're dying on the vines, so they need people. I mean, and they can't afford to pay for those things. Say you bring somebody new in, good for the job, but and you're only talking maybe one or two people in the community.
Yeah.
In these particular things, maybe three. So it's not much. I can see your concern as far as quote double dipping, but you know. That might be to some people's benefit too. It gives them an opportunity to live where they want to live. A lot of times people like to go to our part of the country, go to Wallowa County, it's a wonderful place to live. 7,000 people in the county, you know, average wage is about $18,000 a year up there. You can't get people to come into that county to live there. And you get young, upwardly mobile people moving to a rural area, it just doesn't happen.
Representative Nolan, do you have a question?
I did have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, can you help refresh me? What's the unemployment rate in some of those counties?
They're 10%. They fluctuate mostly seasonally. In agriculture, in the summertime, they're probably down to 7-8. In the wintertime, they're sometimes up as high as 15. But it's largely an uneducated workforce. And a lot of these jobs that we're talking about here, you have to have a certain requirements and training.
Thanks.
Most of these folks are, a lot of these folks are timber workers and don't have jobs.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, one of the things that we're faced with in the more rural parts of Mahaska County, Harney County, Baker County, Grant County, in House District 60, is that as much as people may want to eventually try to get out there, housing isn't available, and we're finding that, and perhaps this is what you're looking at when you look at Wallowa County, that yes, you could probably go ahead and attract some folks if you had the higher wage jobs, but then they want to build a home, and that's one of the problems that I have with this rural road district issue is that in Juntura, you can't build a home right now. It's a rural service district. And there are virtually no new residences in the rural service district of Juntura probably for 50 or 60 years, and with land use planning, it would almost be impossible. And I'm going to guess that's probably what you're faced with in Wallowa, that when people come, they say, yes, I'll take that $35,000 a year job if I can find the right location to buy or acquire a home, and that's. That's a real difficult situation, and then once they find out that the community doesn't have the schools and the other amenities, there's no place to shop for groceries, for instance, in Ironside or in Juntura, and that's where the rural road districts are located. They can't, and once you get there, you can't stay, and there really isn't a lot. But I'm wondering if maybe this is a land use discussion in part at that point.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Butler. I think that's probably true. And then another point I'd like to bring out is that a lot of these school districts in our part of the country, we don't hire people from Oregon. We hire people from Montana and Idaho. You go to those job fairs for those schools, a lot of those people come from there. In fact, my son-in-law, he married a girl from Montana. He was teaching at a small school out in western Oregon. She was from Chester, Montana. Because they get a little bit better pay out here. But the pay in our part of the country isn't quite as good as the pay is in the valley. So it's just a vicious cycle, I think, with Representative Butler. I'm trying to impress people. And this is just a tool, a solution for these folks to provide some good services and get some people with experience to help children with their teaching.
Well, we have the senator here and the benefit of his presence. Let's try to finish up on our questions. We've got floor session starting basically right now, and I don't want to hold that up. So let's finish with these questions. Representative Brown, I think you had one. Anybody else?
I guess I can wait.
Okay.
I just make a point more than a question is that I know in Newport and probably in other small communities, whenever we went to hire our police chief, the applicants would be predominantly retired police officers from out of the state. Because you didn't get them from locally, because most of them were under the PERS and retired under PERS, and so they would not apply because they couldn't hold those positions. So we would hire from the state of Washington or the state of California. I know the police officer for the police chief job in
in our town if they didn't promote them within. But the last two I know came from the state of Washington.
Representative Barker, I didn't want to cut you off.
That's okay.
If you have a question for Senator Nelson, I don't want to have to have him come back on Thursday.
Senator Nelson, I heard on the doorstep, I'm from Washington County, which is pretty populated, but part I'm in is very populated. I got a lot of complaints from people about the teachers and the people at the employment shop, their neighbors, who retired and were drawing these pensions and still holding on to those jobs and just plugging up the system. And I know your situation's different, but I kind of think along the same lines as Representative Richardson, that maybe we can open some jobs up for people, and people that are retired can retire, move on. And I know with the chiefs of police, I think the last time I looked, the national average of a chief of police was about 18 months, and we always, the working cop always consider them itinerant workers anyway, but.
But to brought up another point, I think of the 22 school districts in my district, superintendents, I'll bet half of them are retired Washington state superintendents who are retired in the Washington system, and they pop over into Oregon. So it's not a black and white situation. Yeah. It's not going to bring people in here. This is a flexible, on-the-ground solution, and I really hope that you would seriously consider it.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325A, and I'm going to adjourn committee, and we are needed on the floor, colleagues.
Okay.